Greetings, carbon-based life forms inexplicably terrified of carbon. Welcome to Spider on the Web 75, the podcast being posted before it's due just to confuse you. The brilliant Vancouver composer-guitarist Les Finnegan just acquired a magnificent new axe handmade for him by renowned luthier Fabrizio Alberico and shows it off in his latest CD, The Fiery Cart. Here to kick things off is a track from it whose title is, I assure you, only figuratively true, Fret Buzz. Sweet. I buy all my own Les Finnegan CDs and DVDs from Vancouver's premier SF and fantasy bookstore, White Dwarf, where Les's latest discs are always prominently displayed by the register whenever I fall by. That's how I got turned on to Les in the first place. But if you're not within driving range of White Dwarf, my sympathies, and you can get your Les Finnegan CDs and DVDs either by phoning 1-888-884-6343 or by visiting lesfinnegan.com, that's LESFINNIGAN.com. I'll play you some more or less later on, but right now I want to hip you, if you ain't already hip, to one of the best young folk singer-songwriters to come out of Boston since the 60s. This is Ellis Paul singing and playing his own composition, Rose Tattoo, last 4th of July at the Personal Journeys Workshop in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
I got laid off, it's Monday, I'm calling to tell you, don't sit with me well. I feel like I failed you. You say we got each other, that's plenty enough, and I know that's true. But we got one kid coming and one still in diapers. It's a rainy drive home with one good wiper. Leave the porch light on, I need a beacon just to pull me to you. If I ever lost you, I would be lost too, just drifting in a sea of blue. You're in my skin like a rose tattoo, like a rose tattoo, like a rose tattoo. The economy's crashing and this poor boy's laughing, 'cause there's nothing to lose. We don't live in no mansion, there's no bling to put on, only Walmart fashion will do. Inside the house, the baby's screaming and the pasta's steaming. I look through the windows, it feels like I'm dreaming. You pull the door open, say, "Daddy, when you coming home?" Baby, if I love, I would be lost too, just drifting in a sea of blue. You're in my skin like a rose tattoo, like a rose tattoo, like a rose tattoo. You say we'll fight for the best case scenario. Trouble in the alleys out back, but we've got love in these patterns. Love is what matters, baby. I got your back. I've got your back.
Came from at www.ellispaul.com. That's ellispaul.com. And now it's time to bring you the second and final portion of the splendid Cory Doctorow novella I began reading to you in my last podcast, Human Readable. I'll set the mood for it with a couple of evocative tracks from Because We Hear Voices, a tasty new musical anthology, unquote, just released on CD by On Spec, the Canadian magazine of the fantastic. To score your own copy of Because We Hear Voices, or to learn more about the impeccable On Spec magazine, visit www.onspec.ca. Here now are W.J. Pleca, forgive me if I've mispronounced P-L-E-C-H-A, with the On Spec theme, immediately followed by Rhonda Rosalie's Promised Land. And now, with further ado, here is part two of Human Readable by Cory Doctorow. Their 35th date was their last. "You're going back to Washington," he said when he saw the boxes in her office. "Yes," she said. He stood in the doorway of her office. Trish was painfully aware of the other faculty members in the corridor watching him. Their romance was no secret, of course. Everyone in the law department knew about him, all the network engineers knew about her, and they both took a substantial amount of ribbing about mixed marriages and interfaith dating. Trish realized with a pang that it was likely that everyone in the law department knew that she'd decided to go back to the Hill, but that he'd only suspected it until this instant. "Well, good for you," he said, putting on a brave face that was belied by the fret wrinkles in his forehead. "I'm sorry," she said. "I should have told you once I decided, but I didn't want to do it over the phone." "I'm glad you didn't," he said, holding up his hand. "Do you want to come out for dinner with me anyway?" She gestured at the half-packed office. "The movers are coming in the morning." "Well, then, do you suppose you could use some help? I could get some Burger King or Taco Bell." She looked at him for a long moment, swallowing the knob in her throat. "That would be lovely. Taco Bell," she said. "Thank you." He let her pay for it. "You're making the big bucks now," he said. And he was a surprisingly conscientious packer, padding her framed pictures carefully and wrapping her knick-knacks in individual sheets of spun fiber. "Well, then," he said, once he'd finished writing out a description of his latest box's contents on its outside, "you always told me that hill rats were hill rats for life, I suppose." "Yeah," she said. She knew she should explain, but they'd had the argument about it three times since the new pack had contacted her and offered her the executive director position. The explanation wouldn't get any better now that she'd made up her mind. The new pack, the Association for a Human Readable World, was the brainchild of some people she'd worked with while she was on the Hill. They'd asked her to hire a team, to scout an office, and then to camp out in the offices of various important committee chairmen until they passed a law limiting the scope of emergent networking meshes. The Europeans had enacted legislation requiring cops, hydroelectric agencies, banks, hospitals, and aviation authorities to use interrogatable networks within 10 days of the downtime. With 15,000 dead in Western Europe alone, with Florence in flames and Amsterdam under 2 meters of water, it was an easy call. The U.S. had scoffed at them and pointed to the economic efficiencies of a self-governing network, but the people who were funding Human Readable World wanted to know where old concepts like transparency and accountability and consent of the governed fit in when the world's essential infrastructure was being managed by non-sentient ant colony simulations. "Be gentle with us, okay?" he said. "Oh, I wish I had your confidence in my abilities," she said, sucking on her big gulp of Coke. He put down his food and looked hard at her. He stared longer than was polite, even for ex-lovers, and she began to squirm. "What?" she said. "You're not putting me on. Amazing. Patricia Lourdes McCavity, you have felled an empire, and you are setting yourself up to fell another, and it's one that I'm pretty heavily invested in, both professionally and financially." "Come on," she said. "I'm good, but I'm not Superwoman. I was part of a team. I've read your briefs. Position papers, opinions, speeches, hell, your press releases. They were the most cogent, convincing explanations for intellectual property reform I'd ever read. You weren't the judge, but you were his clerk. You weren't the committee chairman, but you were her head staffer. Taco Bell underestimated you. Coke underestimated you. Starbucks underestimated you. Disney underestimated you. Vivendi and Sony underestimated you. Now you're running your own organization, and it's pointed at me, and I'm scared shitless. You want to know the truth? I'm not underestimating you." He'd drawn his dark eyebrows together while he spoke and lowered his head so that he was looking up at her from under his brow, looking intense as the day they'd met, when he was delivering a brilliant lecture on ant colony optimization to a large lay audience at the law school, fielding the Q&A with such convulsive humor and scalding lucidity that he'd melted her heart. She felt herself blushing, then wondered if she was flushing. She still loved him and still craved the feeling of his skin on hers. Wanted nothing more than another lost weekend with him, taking turns being the strong one and being the one who surrendered, soothing each other and spoiling each other. Thinking of that first meeting brought back all those feelings with keen intensity that made her breasts ache and her hands flutter on the box she was eating off of. "Rayner," she began, then stopped. She took a couple of deep breaths. I'm not gunning for you, you know. You and I want the same thing, a world that we could be proud to live in. Your family's company has contributed more to the public good than any of us can really appreciate. He blushed too, now. She never talked about his father's role in the earliest build-outs of ant-based emergent routing algorithms, about the family fortune that he'd amassed through the company that bore his name still 30 years after he'd stepped down as chairman of the board. Rayner was a genius in his own right, she knew, and his own contribution to the field was as important as his father's, but he was haunted by the idea that his esteem in the field was due more to his surname than his research. He waved his hands at her, and she waved hers back. "Shush, I'm trying to explain something to you. Between your father and you, the world has increased its capacity and improved its quality of life by an order of magnitude. You've beaten back Malthus for at least another century. That makes you heroes. But your field has been co-opted by corrupt interests. When you study the distributions, you can see it clearly. The rich and the powerful get to their destinations more quickly. The poor are routed through franchise ghettos and onto toll roads. The more important you are, the fewer number of connections you have to make when you fly, the better the chance that you'll get a kidney when you need it. The evidence is there for anyone to see, if only you look. We need standards for this. We need to be able to interrogate the system and find out why it does what it does. That's an achievable goal and a modest one. We're just asking for the same checks and balances that we rely on in the real world.
He looked away and set down his taco.
"Trish, I have a lot of respect for you. Please remember that when I tell you this. You are talking nonsense. The network is by definition above corruption. You simply can't direct it to give your cronies a better deal than the rest of the world. The system is too complex to game. Its behavior can't be predicted. How could it possibly be guided? Statistics can be manipulated to prove anything, but everyone who has any clue about this understands that this is just paranoid raving." She narrowed her eyes and sucked in a breath, and he clamped his lips shut, breathed heavily through his nose, and went on. "Sorry. It's just wrong, is all. Science isn't like law. You deal with shades of gray all the time, make compromises, seek out balance. I'm talking about mathematical truths here, not human-created political constructs. There's no one to compromise with. A human-readable emergent network just doesn't exist. Can't exist. It doesn't make sense to say it. It's like asking for me to make pi equal 3. Pi means something, and what it means isn't 3. Emergent networks mean, not human-readable." She looked at him, and he looked at her, and they looked at each other. She felt a sad smile in the corners of her lips and saw one tug at his, and then they both broke out in grins. "We're going to be seeing a lot of each other," she said. "Oh, yes, we are," he said. "Across a committee room, a podium, on talk shows, opposite sides." "Right. Well, no fighting dirty, okay?" he said, raising his eyebrows and showing her his big brown eyes. She snorted. "Give me a hug and go home," she said. "I'll see you at the hearings when they introduce my bill." He hugged her, and she smelled him, thinking, "This is the last time I'll smell this smell." "Rayner," she said, holding him at arm's length. "Yes," he said. "I'm going to call you when I have questions about ant colony optimization, all right?" He looked at her. "I need the best expertise I can get. It's in your interest to see to it that I'm well informed." Slowly he nodded. "Yes, you're right. I'd like that. I'll call you when I have questions about policy, all right?" "You're on," she said, and they hugged again, fiercely. Once he was gone, she permitted herself the briefest of tears. She knew that she was right and that she was going to make a fool out of him, but she didn't want to think of that right then. She felt the place behind her ear where he'd kissed her before going home and looked around her office, 5 years of her life in 30 banker's boxes ready to be shipped across the country tomorrow, according to a route that would be governed from moment to moment by invisible, notional, ridiculous insects. She ate more Taco Bell. The logo was a pretty one, really, and now that it had been adopted by every mom-and-paparito joint in the world, it really leveled the playing field. She thought about the old Taco Bell mystery meat and plastic cheese and took a bite of the ground beef and sharp Monterey Jack that had come from her favorite little place on the corner and permitted herself to believe, for a second anyway, that she'd made that possible. She was going to kick Aunt Ass on the hill.
3. Conflict of Insect. Trish gathered her staff in the boardroom and wrote the following in glowing letters on the wall with her fingertip, leaving the text in her expressive schoolmarm's handwriting rather than converting it to some sterile font. First they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win. Her staff, all 5 of them, chuckled softly. Recognize it? She asked, looking round at them. Pee-wee Herman, said the grassroots guy, who was so young it ached to look at him, but who could fire a cannon load of email into any congressional office on 12 hours' notice. He never stopped joking. The lawyer cocked an eyebrow at him and stroked her mustache, a distinctive gesture that you could see in any number of court TV archives of famous civil rights battles, typically just before she unloaded both barrels at the jury box and set one or another of her many precedents. It's Martin Luther King, right? Close, Trish said.
Geronimo,
guessed the paralegal, who probably wasn't going to work out after all, being something of a giant flake who spent more time on the phone to her girlfriend than filing papers and looking up precedents. Nope, Trish said, looking at the other 2 staffers, the office manager and the media guy, who shrugged and shook their heads. It's Gandhi, she said. They all went, oh, except the grassroots guy who crossed to the wall and used his fingertip to add, and then they assassinate you. I'm too tough to die, the lawyer said, and you're all too young, so I think we're safe. Okay, Trish said, this is an official pep talk. They're playing dirty now. Last night, my car tried to take me to Arlington via Detroit. My email is arriving on a 72-hour time delay. My phone doesn't ring, or it rings all night long. I've had to switch it off. But what all of this means is that I've got more uninterrupted work time than ever, and I'm getting reacquainted with my bicycle.
Every number I call rings at my ex-girlfriend's place, the grassroots guy said. I think we're going to get back together.
That's the right attitude, boyo, the lawyer said. When life gives you SARS, make sarsaparilla. I appear to be unable to access any of my personal files, and any case law I query shows up 1 sentence at a time. I have discovered that the Georgetown University Law Library makes a very nice latte and serves a terrific high tea, and I've set Giselle to work on refiling and cross-indexing 20 years' worth of yellow pads that had previously sat moldering in a storage locker I was paying far too much for. Which has given Giselle a rare opportunity to explore the rich civil rights history that you embody, Trish said, looking pointedly at the paralegal. But I suspect that she could use a hand, possibly from a grad student or two, who could get some credit for this. Let's ask around at Georgetown, okay? The lawyer nodded. The office manager pointed out that their bill payments were going astray after they'd been dispatched to their suppliers, but before they were debited from their dwindling account, which meant that they were getting a couple of days' worth of free cash flow. Only the media guy was glum, since he couldn't field, make, or review calls or press releases, which made him pretty useless indeed. Right, she said, and scribbled something on one of the steno pads she'd bought for everyone when their emails started going down 3 times a day. This guy owes me from back in the copyright wars. I fed him some good stories that he used to launch his career. He was the ABNBC Washington bureau chief until last year, and now he's teaching J school at Columbia. Take the afternoon train to Manhattan and bring him back with you tonight. Don't take no for an answer. Tell him to bring his 3 most promising protégés and tell him that they'll have all the access they need to produce an entire series on the campaign. Sleeping on our sofas, following us to the toilet, everything on the record. Doable? It's doable, the media guy said. I'm on it. Once they'd all cleared out, the lawyer knocked on her door. You going to be all right? She asked. Trish waved her hands at the piles of briefing books, red-lined hard copies, marked-up magazine articles and memos from her board of directors.
Of course, she said.
She shook her head. Probably. We never thought we'd get this far, remember? All this psyops shit they're pulling, it's just more proof that we're on the right track. No one should be able to do this. It's the opposite of democracy. It's the opposite of civil discourse. The lawyer smoothed her mustache.
Right on, she said. You should be proud. This is a hell of a fight, and I'm glad to be part of it. You know we'd follow you into the sun, right?
Trish fluttered her hands. God, don't give me that kind of responsibility.
All right, then, into the ocean. We're making this happen, is what's important.
Thanks, babe, Trish said. She put on a brave smile until the lawyer had backed out of the office, then stared down at her calendar and looked at her morning schedule. 3 congressional staffers, a committee co-chair, an ACLU researcher, and the head of the newly formed Emergent Network Suppliers Industry Association, a man she had last seen in her office at UCLA, backing away from a long and melancholy hug.
When he rang off the phone and joined her, finally, she straightened out her smart cardigan and said, "Rayner, you're certainly looking well."
"Funded," he finished with a small smile. The Emergent Network Suppliers Industry Association's new offices were in a nice Federal Revival building off DuPont Circle, with lots of stained glass that nicely set off the sculptural and understated furniture.
"It's not as grand as appearances suggest, Trish. We got it for a song from the receivers in the Church of Scientology's bankruptcy, furnishings included. It is nice, though, don't you think?"
"It's lovely," she said.
Around her, staffers bustled past in good suits and good shoes and smart haircuts.
"Hard to believe you only set up shop a week ago," she said.
"Well, it came furnished, remember," he said.
"Oh, yes, so you said," she said, watching a kid who looked like he'd gone tops in his class at the Naval Academy put his ankles up on the plasticized return beside his desk and tilt his chair, throwing his head back with wild laughter at whatever it was some other hill rat, in her mind it was a key congressman's aide, some old frat buddy of Mr. Navy 2048, was saying on the phone's other end. She looked back, and Rayner saw that he was staring where she had.
"Well, it's a far cry from academic research," he said.
"I know you'll be very good at it. You can explain things without making it seem like an explanation. First lesson I ever learned on the Hill was, if you're explaining, you're losing," he said.
"Yeah, I've heard that. Well, you're the old hand here. I'm just learning as I go, trying not to make too many mistakes and to learn from the ones I do make."
"Do you want some free advice, Rayner?"
He sat down in one of the chairs, which bulged and sloshed as it conformed itself to his back and butt. He patted the upholstered jelly beside him.
"You may always assume that I would be immensely grateful for your advice, Trish," he said.
She sat down and crossed her legs, letting the sensible shoe hang loose.
"Right. D.C. is a busy place, and in academic circles and tech circles you might get together to feel out your opponent or make someone's acquaintance or to see an old friend. You might get together to enjoy the company of another human being. We do that in D.C. after working hours. Strictly evenings and weekends. When you schedule a meeting during office hours, it has to have a purpose. Even if it appears to have no purpose, it has a purpose. There's a protocol to meetings, a secret language that's known to every hill rat and written nowhere. What time you have the meeting, who's there, who's invited, who knows it, how long you schedule, whether you cater, they all say little things about the purpose of the meeting. Even if you have no reason to call a meeting, one will be read into it. If this was any other city in the world, it would make perfect sense for you to look me up once you got to D.C. We're still friends. I still think about you from time to time. But here in D.C., you calling me over for a meeting, this kind of meeting at this time of day, it means you're looking to parley. You want to strike a deal before my bill goes to the committee. I don't know how well you know the Hill, so I don't want to impute any motives to you. But if you took a meeting like this with anyone else, that's what they'd assume."
Rayner's forehead crinkled. "No fretting," she said. Then she smiled a sad smile.
"Oh, fret if you want. You're a big boy."
He twiddled his thumbs, caught himself at it, and folded his hands in his lap.
"Huh," he said. "Well, I did want to talk to you because it's been a while and because we meant a lot to each other. I also wanted to talk to you about the bill because that's what I'm here to do at a pretty decent salary. I also wanted to see you because I had an idea that you'd be different here in your native habitat, and, well, that's true."
She refused to let that make her self-conscious.
Of course she was different, but it wasn't geographic. The last time they'd seen each other, they were lovers and friends. Now, they were ex-lovers who were being paid to accomplish opposing, mutually exclusive objectives. She knew that there was a certain power in not saying anything, so she wrapped herself in silence and waited for him to say something. She didn't have to wait long.
"Your bill is going to committee."
"Well, I certainly hope so," she said. "That's what I'm here for, after all. The discussion draft has been circulating for a week, and we're confident we'll see it introduced and assigned to committee by the end of this week. That's what we're told, anyway. It's got strong bipartisan support. Selling Congress on the importance of human-generated governance is pretty easy. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes."
He grinned. "You're trying to psych me out."
"Maybe," she said, grinning back. "But that's nothing compared to the psych job that we've been getting down at my office." She told him about the phone weirdness, the oddball traffic management.
"Someone on your side has a funny sense of humor."
His smile faded.
"You're still trying to fake me out," he said. "If you're seeing corruption in the net, it's because you're looking so hard you can't help but find it. You're reading malice into accident.
Dead spots aren't personal, you know. This is a law of nature. The networks emerge solutions are the best they can come up with. If you don't like the results, talk to nature, not me.
She shrugged. Whatever, Rayner, I know what's happening. You'll believe what you want to believe.
She pursed her lips and made an effort at controlling her irritation.
It's really happening, and it's not helping your side. If you know who's responsible, you might let him know that the dirty tricks are what convinced Senator Beecham's staff to greenlight the bill. Conspiracy is supposed to be beneath the surface. It doesn't look so good when it's exposed to fresh air and sunshine.
You've got to be kidding, he said.
Doesn't matter, I suppose.
All right, message received. If I happen to run into someone whom I think should hear it, I'll be sure to pass it on, okay?
That's all I ask, she said.
You want to talk about the bill now?
Have you seen the discussion draft?
He squirmed.
No, he admitted. I didn't know it existed until just now.
I'd offer to send you a copy, but I expect it would take a week to arrive if it ever did.
Why don't you ask that guy, she gestured at the Navy man, to get you a copy. He looks like he knows his way around, and then drop by my office if you want to chat about it.
She stood up and tugged at her cardigan again.
It's been very nice seeing you, she said. She picked up her coat and her mitts. Good luck settling in.
He gave her a hug, which felt weird. Hugging was strictly west of the Mississippi, and she broke it off firmly, and showed her to the door. The first snows were coming in, and the steps were slightly icy, so she maneuvered them slowly, carefully. When she reached the road, he was no longer in the doorway. He was standing still right behind her, breath coming out in foggy huffs.
Trish, he said, then stopped. His arms dropped to his sides, and his shoulders slumped.
Rayner, she said, keeping her voice calm and neutral.
God, he said. God. How'd this happen, Trish? Look, I've never been happy the way I was with you. I haven't been that happy since. God, Trish,
Rayner, she said again, taking one of his hands, firmly, motherly.
Rayner, stop it. You're here to do a job, and your job requires that you and I keep it on a professional level. It doesn't matter how it happened.
But it did, didn't it?
She'd left him to come east and do something he thought of as wrong-headed and backwards and superstitious. But she'd left him, not the other way around. And he'd never recovered, though she'd built herself a new life here. It wasn't a contest, but she was winning anyway.
It doesn't matter. We respect each other. That's enough.
He deflated, and she said, Oh, come here, and gave him a long and soulful hug right there on the street, knowing that she was giving the hug and he was taking it. Then she let him go, spun him round, and gave him a little push back toward his office. By the time she reached the corner and looked back over her shoulder, he was nowhere to be seen. That afternoon, her phone started ringing normally, with actual people on the other end. Her outbound calls were connected. Her email was delivered. Her car got her home in record time. She sighed as she eased it into her driveway and carried her briefcase inside and poured herself a very small glass of Irish whiskey, so rare that it had been known to make grown men weep. Normally she saved it for celebrations, but if she was celebrating something, she was damned if she knew what it was. Her phone rang as she was licking the last few drops of liquor from the little glass. It was the lawyer with news. I just stopped by the office and found a messenger on the doorstep. He had a hard copy of a press release from Senator Beecham's office. They're introducing the bill in the morning. Congrats, kid. You did it.
Trish set the glass down and said, Whoopee, very quietly and very emphatically.
You're darn tootin', the lawyer said, and double for me.
Of course, it wasn't over by a long shot. Getting a bill introduced was not the same as getting it through committee. Getting it through committee was not the same as getting it passed in the Senate, and getting it passed in the Senate was not the same as getting it passed in the House, and then who the hell knew what the hereditary chimp-in-chief in the Oval Office would do when it was passed through the bars of his cage with his morning banana. But she had ridden back into town less than a year before, and she had gone from nothing to this. The ACLU was supporting the bill, and EFF, EPIC, all the old Civ Lib Mafia had opened their arms to her. She poured herself one more very small whiskey, gave herself a fragrant bath, and put herself to bed, grinning like a fool.
There are 4 news crews, 6 print reporters, and a couple of others here to see you, the office manager said.
The office phones were out again, but that hadn't stopped a fair number of determined people from figuring out that they could actually move their physical being from one part of Washington to another and have a real old-fashioned face-to-face. The lawyer and she had each taken a dozen press calls that morning with their embedded reporters from Columbia J School perched obtrusively in the corners of their offices, taking copious notes and filming constantly.
Others? A mixed bag. Some Hill people, some I'm not sure about.
Trish stood and stretched out her back, listening to it pop. She usually worked in bursts, typing or talking for an hour, then taking a little walk to gather her thoughts and touch base with her co-workers. Today she'd been glued to her seat from 7 a.m. to after lunchtime, and her back and butt were shrieking at her. She walked into the front area, trailed by her reporter. She recognized some of the journos and some of the congressional staffers and a local rep from a European privacy think tank in Brussels and... Rayner. He was turned out in a very natty suit and a Homburg, a fashion that had recently come back to D.C., and she knew that he'd been put together by a personal shopper. Her own board had suggested to her, matter-of-factly, that she should get one of her own once the bill cleared committee, since she'd be doing tons of press, and as sharp a dresser as she fancied herself, she was no pro. Her prodigious talents, they assured her, lay elsewhere. He took her hand with both of his and gave her a long, intense handshake that drew stares from the journos and the think tank man. "Nice to see you again, Ms. McCavity," he said somberly. "A pleasure as always, Mr. Feinstein," she said. "I'm sorry to drop in on you unannounced," he said, "but I hoped that I could have just a moment of your time." Belatedly, he remembered to take off his silly hat, and then he fumbled with the right way to hold it, settling for dropping it to his waist and upending it. She thought he looked like a panhandler in a Charlie Chaplin movie, and she suppressed a smile. His curly hair had been gelled into a careful configuration that reminded her of the glossy ringlets of a black poodle. "I suppose we can do that," she said. She turned to her other visitors. "Who's got a 3 p.m. deadline?" she said. Two of the print reporters held up their hands. "You, then you," she said. "Who's got a 5 p.m. filing deadline? 6 p.m.? 10 p.m.? She triaged them all, promised to meet the think tank man for dinner at an Ethiopian place in Adams Morgan, and led Rayner into her office and closed the door. He looked at her embedded reporter and cocked his head. "Sorry, Rayner," she said. "I have a shadow for the duration. Just pretend he isn't here." "You don't mind, do you, dear?" she said to the reporter, who was very young and very bright and missed nothing. He shook his head and made some notes. "The bill's dead," Rayner said, after he'd sat down. "Oh, really?" she said. "Just heard from Senator Rittenhouse personally. He takes the position that this should be in Commerce, not Judiciary, and is calling hearings to make that happen." Rittenhouse was another powerful committee chairman, and this wasn't good news. What's more, he was in the pocket of the network operators and had been for a decade, so much so that editorialists and talk radio types called him the Senator from the Internet. Still, it wasn't catastrophic. "That's interesting," she said, "but it's a far cry from killing the bill. It's pretty standard, in fact. Just slows things down." She smiled at him. He was just a kid sometimes, so out of his depth here. He reminded her of the relatives she'd met that day, the little boys in their miniature suits, running on the beach. He shifted in his seat and fondled his hat brim. "Well, I guess we'll see. My press liaison has set up a post-mortem debate on one of the news networks tonight, and I thought you might want to represent the other side." She smiled again. He was twice the rhetorician that she was, but he had no idea how to play the game. She'd have to be careful to bruise, not break him.
"We as a society make trade-offs all the time," Rayner said.
He was wearing a different suit this evening, something that Trish had to admit looked damn good on the studio monitors, better than her frumpy blouse and wool winter weight trousers.
"We trade a little bit of privacy for a little bit of security when we show identification before going into a federal building."
The Ewok held up his paw.
"But how much should we be willing to trade, Ms. McCavity?"
She looked into the camera, keeping her eyes still, the way she'd been told to if she didn't want to appear Touretic.
"Wicket, when Franklin said those willing to give up a little liberty for a little security deserve neither security nor liberty, he wasn't spouting empty rhetoric. He was laying the groundwork for this enduring democratic experiment that we all love. Look, we're not opposed to the use of autonomous networks for some applications, even most applications, with appropriate safeguards and checks and balances. No nation on earth has the reliance that we do on these networks. Are they an appropriate way of advising you on the best way to get to the mall on a busy Saturday? Absolutely, provided that everyone gets the best advice the system can give, regardless of economic status or influence. But should they be used to figure out whom the FBI should open an investigation into? Absolutely not. We use judges and grand juries and evidence to establish the sufficiency of a request to investigate a private citizen who is considered innocent until proven guilty. We learned that lesson the hard way during the war on terrorism and the Ashcroft witch hunts. Should we trade grand juries and judges for ant colonies? Do you want the warrant for your wiretap issued by an accountable human being or by a simulated anthill? The Ewok turned to the camera.
Both sides make a compelling case. What do you think? When we come back, we'll take your calls and questions.
The lights dimmed, and it adjusted its collar and cracked its hairy knuckles on the table before it. Ever since it had made the move to a PBS, it had been grooming its fur ever more conservatively and trying out a series of waistcoats and short pants. It turned to her and stared at her with its saucer-sized black button eyes.
You know, I just wanted to say thanks. I had self-identified as an Ewok since I was 5 years old, but Lucasfilm just wouldn't license the surgery, so I went through every day feeling like a stranger in my own body. It wasn't until your law got enacted that I was able to find a doctor who'd do it without permission.
She shook its paw. Well, it wasn't my law, but I helped. I'm glad it helped you out. She unconsciously wiped her palm on her thigh as the Ewok turned to his makeup boy and let him comb out its cheeks. She stared at Raynor, who wasn't looking good. She'd had him on the ropes since their opening remarks, and the Ewok kept interrupting him to let her rebut, and now she knew why. Raynor had his phone clamped to his head, and he was nodding vigorously and drumming his fingers. He was sweating, and it was making his hair come uncoiffed. Trish's own phone buzzed, and she looked down at it in surprise. It was her voicemail coming back to life again. It had started when she got to the studio. When she got within a few yards of Raynor, she realized. Messages coming in. She'd transcribed a dozen in the green room before they dragged her into makeup. The studio lights blinked, and Raynor popped the phone back into his pocket, and the Ewok turned to look back into the camera, examining the ticker scrolling past his prompter. He introduced them again, then turned to Trish.
Miss McCavity, Alberto in San Juan writes in wanting to know what changes we should institute in the networks.
She said, It's not my place to say what technical changes the networks need to have. That's where experts like Mr. Feinstein come in. We'd ask the administrative branch to solicit comments from people like him to figure out exactly what technical changes could be made to allow us to remain competitive without giving up our fundamental liberties in order to beat the occasional traffic jam.
Mr. Feinstein?
He grinned and leaned forward. It's interesting that Ms. McCavity should disavow any technical expertise, since that's what we've been saying all along. If she's getting stuck in traffic, it's because there's a lot of traffic. The AntNets route 5,000% more traffic than our nation's highways ever accommodated without them, and they've increased the miles per hour per capita per linear mile by 6,400%. You're stuck in traffic? Fine, I get stuck sometimes too. But for every hour you spend stuck today, you're saving hundreds of hours relative to the time your parents spent in transit. The other side of this debate are asking for something impossible. They want us to modify the structure of the network, which is a technical construct built out of bits and equations, to accommodate a philosophical objective. They assert that this is possible, but it's like listening to someone assert that our democracy would be better served if we had less gravity, or if 2 + 2 = 5. Whether or not that's true, it's not reasonable to ask for it. The Ewok turned to her. She said, Well, we've heard a great deal about the impossibility of building democratic fundamentals into the network, but nothing about the possibilities. This hard, no-compromise line is belied by the fact that we know that the rich and powerful manipulate the network to their own advantage, something that statistics have proven out. See, this is exactly how those human-readable types do it. It's how their media training goes. They are here to ask for changes to technical specifications, but they disavow any technical knowledge. And when they're called on this, they spout dubious statistics that prove that up is down, black is white, and that millionaires can get to the movies in half the time that paupers can. The Emergent Network Suppliers Industry Association represents the foremost experts in this field, but you don't need to be an expert to know that these networks work. The ants take us where we want to go, in the shortest time, with the highest reliability. Anyone who doubts that can dig out her map and compass and sextant and try to navigate the world without their assistance, the way they do in Europe. Her mouth was open, Media training? Where did he get this business about media training? I'm not sure where Mr. Feinstein gets his information about my media training, but personally, I'd rather talk about networks. She paused. Let's talk about Europe, where they have found ways of creating transparency and accountability for these unregulatable algorithms, where the sky hasn't fallen and the final trump hasn't sounded. What do they know that we don't?
What indeed, the Ewok said, breaking in and giving her the last word again. More of your questions after this break.
They got in their cars together after they'd scrubbed off their makeup and shaken paws with the Ewok, riding down in the elevator shoulder to shoulder, slumped and sweaty and exhausted. They didn't speak, and the silence might have been mistaken for companionable by someone who didn't know any better. They got off at the same floor in the parking garage and turned in the same direction, and Trish spied his car parked next to hers, the last two on the floor. Quickening her step, she opened her door and turned the car on, backing up so that she was right behind Rayner. He backed out slowly, looking at her quizzically in his rear view, but she refused to meet his eye, and when he pulled out, she rode his bumper. "Sweet fancy Moses," she breathed as the traffic parted before them, allowing them to scythe through the streets onto the beltway. She hung grimly onto his bumper, cutting off cars that tried to shift into her lane. Moving this fast after so much time stuck on the roads, it felt like flying. She laughed and then got a devilish idea. Spotting a gap in the passing lane, she zipped ahead of Rayner and swerved back into his lane so that she was in the lead. As though a door had slammed shut, the traffic congealed before them into a clot as thick as an aneurysm. She hissed out a note of satisfaction, then waited patiently while Rayner laboriously passed her again, and the traffic melted away once more. It was tempting not to get off at her exit, but she had to get some sleep, and so she reluctantly changed lanes. There wasn't much traffic on the road, but every traffic light glowed vindictive red all the way to her house. The chairman of her board messengered over a handwritten note of congratulations that was on her doorstep. Beneath it was a note from Rayner's great-aunt, with the best wishes of his mother in neat pen beneath it. She read its kind words as she boiled the kettle and put it into her pile of correspondence to answer. Rayner's great-aunt wanted to know if she had met a nice boy in D.C. yet, but she didn't come right out and say it. Too subtle for that. The women in Rayner's family got all the subtlety, and they recognized their own kind. It was why she and the old lady kept writing to each other. That, and so that the relatives could reassure themselves that someone in full possession of lifeguardly skills and a level head was watching out for Rayner's interests. This business of handwritten, hand-delivered notes and letters was actually kind of charming, she thought, as she put her feet up on her coughing table and opened up her flask of very special Irish whiskey again. She and Rayner went head-to-head in half a dozen more skirmishes that month, her phone popping back to life every time she got within shouting distance of him. The on-again, off-again hearings in both judiciary and commerce never quite materialized. She was better at playing the game, but he was a fast learner, and he had much deeper pockets and working network infrastructure. Her board approved her renting out an empty suite of offices below their office and converting them to bedrooms for her staff for days when their cars couldn't get them home. They secretly borrowed elderly network appliances from relatives or bought them in the dollar-a-pound bin at the Salvation Army, but always within a few hours of being in the possession of someone in the employ of the Association for a Human-Readable World, the devices would seize up and lose their routes to the network. Their offices started to fill up with dead soldiers, abandoned network boxes that no one could get online. The embedded journalists went home after the second week. Their own gear was seizing up, too, as though the curse of the Association for a Human-Readable World was rubbing off on them. They vowed to return when things got interesting again, but they were of no use to anyone without working cameras, mics, and notepads. Christmas came and went, and New Year's, and then February arrived, and the city turned to ice and slush and perpetual twilight. The paralegal quit. She needed a job where the phones worked so that she could call her girlfriend. The media guy took a series of personal days, and she wasn't sure if he'd show up again, but it didn't matter because the press had stopped calling them. Then came the second downtime. It struck during morning rush hour on Valentine's Day, a Monday, and it juddered the whole country to a halt for 8 long days. The hospitals overflowed,
and doctors used motorized scooters to go from one place to another, unable to spread their expertise around with telemedicine. Firemen perished in blazes. Cops arrived too late at crime scenes. Grocery stores didn't get their resupplies, and schools dug out old chalkboards and taught the few students who lived close enough to walk. Fed cops of all description went berserk and could be seen walking briskly from one federal building to another, their faces grim. And suddenly, miraculously, every journalist, policy wonk, staffer, advisor, clerk, and cop in D.C. wanted to have a chat with the Association for a Human Readable World. She hired 3 more people that week and borrowed 4 more from fellow traveler organizations. Paying their salaries for the next 4 weeks would bottom out the group's finances, but she knew that this was now or never, and the board backed her after some nail-biting debate. Rayner showed up on the 4th day of the downtime, and she found him standing, bewildered, in the hustle of her office, as her staffers penned notes on steno pads to their contacts on the Hill and handed them to waiting bicycle couriers in space program warm gear that swathed them from fingertips to eyeballs. She plucked him out of the bustle and brought him back to her office.
"I've got a hell of a nerve," he said, sitting in her guest chair.
"Really?" she said. "I hadn't noticed."
"Well, I haven't been showing it off, but I'm about to.
I need advice. My office is falling apart. You've been living with no communications and no travel for a year now. You know how to make it work. We're completely lost. I've come to throw myself on your mercy."
He looked up at her with his big brown eyes, and then they crumpled shut as he made his fretting face.
"You're playing me, Rayner," she said, "and it won't work. Whatever I feel for you, I've got a job to do, and if this downtime tells us anything, it's that I'm doing the right thing and you're doing the wrong thing."
He hung his head. He wasn't even the slightest bit natty that day. She supposed that his personal assistant was stuck in Falls Church or Baltimore or somewhere, unable to get into the city. Judging from the slush and road salt on his shoes, he must have walked the 2 miles between their offices.
"What's more, I don't have any advice to give you in particular. We're not faring well here because we're doing something differently. We're faring well because we're doing what we've been at all along, because of a network outage that you claim is impossible, is a figment of our imagination. Those bike messengers, we've been their best customers for months now. Everyone else is begging for service from them, but they're always here when we need them. We've got beds and changes of clothes and toilet kits in the offices downstairs. We've been living through a downtime for a couple of quarters now. We've hardly noticed the change. If you want to cope as well as we are, you can go back in time, rent out spare offices to house your staff, establish a good working relationship with a bike messenger company, learn to navigate the metro and the freeways by map, and all the other things we've done here."
He looked defeated. He began to stand, to turn, to leave.
"Rayner," she said. He paused.
"Close the door and sit down," she said. He did, looking at her with so much hope that it made her eyes water.
"Here's my offer," she said. "You and I will lock ourselves in this office with the last draft of my bill. My staff will run interference for me with the Judiciary Committee, and we will draft a version of my bill that we can both live with. We will jointly take it to Senators Beecham and Rittenhouse with our blessings and ask them to expedite it through both committees. Every Congress critter on the Hill is sitting around with his thumb up his ass until the lights come back on. We can get this voted in by Tuesday."
He stared down at his hands.
"I can't do it," he said. "My job is not to compromise. I just can't do it."
"Come on, Rayner, think outside the box for a minute here." Her heart was pounding. This could really be it. This could be the solution she'd been waiting for.
"Even if the bill passes, there's going to be a long deliberation over the contours of the regulation, probably at the FCC. You'll be able to work on the bureau staffers and at the expert agencies, take ex parte meetings and lobby on behalf of your employers. It's all we've ever asked for, an expert discussion where the public interest gets a hearing alongside a private enterprise and government."
But he was shaking his head, standing up to go. "You're probably right, Trish," he said. "I don't know. What I know is I can't do what you're asking of me. They'd just fire me." If the downtime continues, they won't be able to fire you. They won't even know what you're up to until it's too late, and then they'll make the best they can out of it. No one is better qualified to represent your side in the administrative agencies. He put his ridiculous hat on and wrapped his scarf around his neck, and they looked each other in the eyes for a long moment. She waited for the involuntary smile that looking into his eyes inevitably evoked, but it didn't come. I don't understand you, Trish. You won this incredible victory for cooperation, for collective ownership of our intellectual infrastructure. Ant networks demand the same cooperation from the nodes that my phone passed your car's messages to his desk. Let's just set aside the professional politics for a second, just you and me. Tell me, how can you not support this? He looked at her out from under his brows, staring intensely. He swallowed and said, "It was the surfer, wasn't it?" "What?" she said. "The one who died. That's why you're doing this. You want to make up for him." She couldn't believe he'd said it, taken such a cheap shot. "I'm surprised you didn't save that one for television, Rayner. Jesus. No, I'm doing this because it's right. In case you haven't noticed, your self-healing, uncorruptible network is down. People are suffering. The economy is tanking. The death toll is mounting. You won't even bend one inch, one tenth of an inch, because you're worried about losing your job." "Trish," he said, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean..." Her office door opened, and there stood her embedded journalist. "I just got in from Manhattan," he said. "Can I set up in that corner there again?" "Be my guest," she said, grateful for the distraction. Rayner looked at her, forehead scrunched, and then he left. "It's a good thing you're not over him," the lawyer said, pouring her another victory whiskey. The bill had passed the House with only one opposing and two abstentions, and had squeaked through the Senate by 5 seats at 5 minutes to midnight on the 8th day of the downtime. They were halfway to the bar, where the office manager had been feeding 20s to the bartender to stay open, when the grid came back up, crawls springing to life on every surface and cars suddenly zipping forward in the characteristic high-speed ballet of efficiently routed traffic. They'd laughed themselves stupid all the way to the bar, and after a brief but intense negotiation between the lawyer and the barman, he'd produced a bottle of Irish that was nearly half as good as the stuff Trish kept at home. "I'm going to pretend you didn't say that," Trish said, sipping tenderly at the booze. "Come on, girl," the lawyer said, twirling her mustache. "Be serious. You two had so much sexual energy in that room, it's a wonder you didn't make the bulbs explode. It's how you got inside each other's heads. You weren't selling the committee. You were selling him, and that's what made you so effective. We're going to need that again at the FCC, too, so no getting over him until after then." Trish drank her whiskey. She didn't know what to say to that. He'd looked 10 years older tonight in the corridors, whispering to his committee members, to his staffers, his face drooping and wilted. She supposed she didn't look any better. It had been, what, 3 days since she'd had more than an hour's sleep? "I don't get it," she said. "How could he be so dumb? I mean, it's obvious that the system is being gamed, obvious that we're being targeted through it, yet he sits there insisting that white is black, that up is down, that the network is autonomous and immune to all corruption." "It's like a religion for them," the lawyer said. "It doesn't need explaining. It's just right living. It's the law." Trish thought back to the ceremony in the graveyard, the dirge, and the prayers to a god no one believed in. Had Rayner really renounced his faith when he dropped out of yeshiva? "Here's to a human-readable world," Trish said, raising her glass. Around her, the staffers and borrowed staffers and hangers-on and even the barman raised their glasses and cheered. It was warm, and the feeling swelled in her tummy and up her chest and through her face, and she burst out in what felt like the biggest smile of her life. She'd learned a long time ago never to send email while drunk, but it had been too much last night. "What if, Rayner, what if the reason for the downtimes is that someone is manipulating the network and that's breaking it? Do you ever wonder about that? Maybe the network is as good as you say it is, until someone screws it up by trying to get preferential treatment for his pals. Wouldn't that be a kick in the teeth? We get 5 squillion% increases in across-the-board routing efficiency, but in the end it's never enough for people who can't be happy unless they're happier than someone else. The thing that saves the human race. But if we adopt it, it'll destroy us. Irony sucks." She'd signed it, Love. but even drunk she'd had the sense to take that out before sending it. Saying love would have been no more appropriate than saying, "You know, I did save your cousin's life." She'd called in no favors, she'd run no blackmail, and she'd won anyway. He rang her doorbell at 5 a.m. She was barely able to drag herself out of bed. "I figured you'd be getting up to deal with the press soon," he said, and she groaned. He was right. She'd earned some time off, but it'd be a month before she could take it. Too much press to do. She appreciated anew how much work it must have taken to be any of her old bosses from the copyright wars, the judge, the senator, the executive director of the PAC. She was in her robe and he was in jeans and a UCLA sweatshirt. He didn't have any gel in his hair, which was matted down by the knit cap he'd been wearing. He looked adorable. "They fired me this morning," he said. "Oh, hon," she said. "I would have quit," he said. "I'm outmatched." She felt herself blush. Or was she flushing? She was suddenly aware of his smell, the boy smell, the smell that she could smell in his chest, in his scalp, in his tummy, lower. She straightened up and led him into the living room and started the coffee maker going. "When do you fly back, then?" she said. He looked at her, smiling. "I don't know," he said. "I haven't booked a ticket." She felt an answering smile at the corners of her mouth and turned into the fridge to fetch out some gourmet MREs. "Bacon and eggs or pancakes?" she said, then laughed. "I guess bacon is out," she said. "Oh, I'm willing to bet that bacon hasn't been anywhere near a pig," he said, "but I'll have the pancakes if you don't mind." She said everything to Perking and went into the bedroom to pull on something smart and camera-friendly, but everything was in the hamper, so she settled for jeans and a decent shirt from last year's wardrobe. When she opened the door, he was standing right there, taller than her. "I think you're right," he said, "about the network. It's the best explanation I've heard so far." She wrapped herself in silence again, waited for him to say more. "You see, the true neural network is immune to corrupting influences and favoritism. So the existence of corruption and favoritism means that what we've got isn't a true network, which means you're right. We need to have a hearing to get to the bottom of this so that we can build a true network." He smiled bravely. "I thought maybe you could use an expert in your corner who'd say that in a hearing." "Thanks," she said, and slipped under his arm and back into the kitchen. Suddenly, she wanted very much to be back at her office, back with her staff, talking to reporters and overseeing a million details. "I'll think about it." "I'm giving up my apartment at the end of the month, next Monday. I won't be able to afford it without the association's salary," he said. Her place was big. A bedroom, a home office, a living room, and a dining room. It was a serious deal for D.C., even outside the Beltway. It could easily accommodate a second person, even if they weren't sleeping together. Her office, her staff, the press, the bill, her board. "Well," she said, "I've got to get going. I'll shower at the office. I've got to get there in time to catch the Euro press calls. Let me put your breakfast in a bag, okay?" He looked whipsawed. Can I give you a ride?" "No, I'll need my car this afternoon. Thanks, though." She kept her voice light, didn't meet his eyes, kept thinking. Her office, her staff, the bill. "Well," he said. He turned for the door, stopped. She tensed. He turned back to her. "Trish," he said. "It's okay," she said. "It's okay. We just have religious differences, is all." She slipped past him and into her car and left him standing in her driveway. As she asked the car to plot a route for her back to the hill, she dug through her purse for a pocket knife. At the next red light, she took her lapel and slashed at it, opening a rent in her shirt that reflected a little of what her heart was feeling. It made her feel a little better to do it. For Alice. That
That reading of that story will be included in Corey's new audio short story collection, With a Little Help. http://craphound.com for further info. I promised you some more Les Finnegan from his exquisite new CD, The Fiery Cart. Here is Les, dancing around the topic. Here's another brilliant guitarist, the only guitar player Ray Charles was ever polite to, as a matter of fact, captured live with a splendid solo version of a tune he first recorded with CPR, a group consisting of himself and the father and son team of David Crosby and James Raymond. This is the great Jeff Pivar, with vocal assistance from his partner Inger Jorgensen, singing Crosby's lyrics to his own tune, Little Blind Fish. Thank you.
fish in a wide river.
That was taken from a Live in the Living Room concert series recorded by a very hip cat named Otto at Herengracht 160, Amsterdam, and as far as I know, available only by free download from www.dimeadozen.org, a site so popular it can take several hours of repeated attempts to join, but they will, I guarantee you, be the best investment in fine music you've ever made. Downloads that are not only free, but guaranteed guilt-free. If a track is found on Dime, it is not for sale anywhere on Earth, and the artist has not objected to its posting.
Now to take us home, here's something else from dimeadozen.org that perfectly fits my own endorphin receptors, featuring as it does Brazilian music, baritone saxes and bass clarinets, and a slightly bent sense of humor. Here are Maria João and Saxofor, live in Nuremberg in January 2008, blowing From Innsbruck to Porto. Obrigado, Maria. And by the way, Spider on the Web 75 is being brought to you, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial.
Como fera de tioba. E vou uma moeda, juno na nata de urubuza. E vai ver voar, que vovó é a voar, que vovó é a voar. Que vovó é pena, que vovó é deixa urubuza.
Para o barulho.